I want to talk to you, I want to respond to the question, has anyone suspended the laws of economics? The reason I want to talk about this is that so many of my friends keep asking that question. Just the other day, Bill Lehman raised the question while we were messing around at the jacuzzi. And I want to talk about this in a rather systematic way. I think there is a good deal of confusion in the public mind and also considerable confusion in Washington on this question. I don't think that economists are nearly as confused about the question as people say economists are. But the reason that...
That's good news.
The reason that people make statements like this today, you know, they say all the laws of economics seem to have gone by the board, is simply because people no longer expect inflation.
Hear what he says. God never had anything to do with economics.
I don't know. One of the reasons it's difficult to get a session going here is you have to talk loud to overcome the voice of Carol advertising the session.
It gets to be like those stations in Berkeley, California, Minneapolis, that are guaranteed to be no advertisements for classical music, but they spend all their time talking about donations to the station.
Well. All right. So again, the problem is that we have obviously seen in the last couple of years very rapid rates of inflation coupled with recession and high rates of unemployment. And this is what people mean when they say the laws of economics don't seem to be working. People somehow have gotten the notion that the principles of economics teach that inflation and recession can't occur at the same time. Now, that belief that inflation and recession cannot occur at the same time has been held by some economists and may well have been a dominant view in the 50s, but it doesn't go back any further than the 1930s. And if it's one of the laws of economics, it isn't a very old law, and it certainly isn't a law that most economists would hold today. The idea that inflation and recession are opposites in some sense, or at least alternatives, or that you ordinarily wouldn't see the two together, even if they're not quite opposites, you know, maybe sunshine and rain aren't opposites, but you ordinarily don't see the two together. You do at Holden Village, but that's kind of freakish. This view traces back to the 1930s into a book by John Maynard Keynes titled The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money. Though I do not think John Maynard Keynes himself held that view, it certainly was developed by some of his disciples, some of his successors, and it got incorporated into many of the textbooks out of which sophomores learned their principles of economics. It was put in there as the modern theory of national income determination. What I want to do is run through the history of the rise and decline of the view that inflation and recession are opposites. And then spend the remainder of our time talking about or letting you ask questions about the experience of 1974-75, the recession inflation of 74-75. But the key idea of the Keynesian revolution, and since I'm going to refer to the Keynesian revolution again, let me try to date it. John Maynard Keynes wrote that book, The General Theory, in 1936. Actually wrote it at the end of 1935 and was published at the beginning of 36. And because the whole Western world, industrialized world, was in the depth of a prolonged depression, the book attracted a great deal of attention. It had actually been circulating among colleagues for some years prior to that time, so that a large number of influential economists knew what the book contained before it was published. And everybody began talking about it. Keynes was a very interesting and politically active character, so that anything he did tended to attract attention. For all kinds of reasons, anyway, the book created a great stir, and from about 1936 to the outbreak of World War II, it completely dominated discussion in the economics profession. Now, this is what I mean by the period of the Keynesian Revolution, when the economists who were not Keynesians were sort of shunted to the side, and the only people who were being listened to were those who had a piece of the Keynesian message or were developing the Keynesian message. Of course, the World War II suspended activity in economics, as in most the social sciences. But after the war, the Keynesian revolution emerged as the Keynesian orthodoxy. That's when the ideas of John Maynard Keynes, as developed by his disciples, were written out in a very simple and formal fashion and incorporated into the textbooks. And as one of the men most responsible for putting, developing these ideas and getting them into the textbooks, Paul Samuelson, first American winner of the Nobel Prize in economics, Paul Samuelson himself observed, once an idea filters down into the elementary textbooks, it is almost impossible to dislodge, no matter how bad it is. All right, now, the key idea of this Keynesian revolution is the relationship between saving and investment. I think I can make this clear by developing a little diagram that I neatly put on the board there. Jim thinks it looks like a bagel. Some of the other forms in which I've drawn it, it looks like somebody's intestines. But the idea here is that if you simplify the economy, forget about government, and just assume that the economy is divided into two sectors. There are households. That includes all of the individuals, whether they live in families or by themselves. And they own everything. They own all the land, all the labor, all the capital, all the productive resources. You know, the title is finally vested in individuals who live in households. Right? They sell those productive resources, land, labor, capital, and so forth, to businesses. And all production is assumed to take place in the business. So say you're a woman who just runs around and cleans houses. On weekends, you're a business. You're thought of as living over here and selling your bucket and your labor to yourself as a business firm, and then producing output of cleaned floors. The business firms, in return for those productive resources, pay income to the households. You know, wages, interest, rent, profits. What do the households do when they get the income? Well, they buy goodies. Call those consumption expenditures. They purchase refrigerators, automobiles, strawberries, turtleneck shirts, and so forth. And, of course, the businesses give them then the output of goods. That's a nice circular flow system. But to simplify it, I'm just going to get rid of this. Because, see, the income is always equal to the productive resources. It's an exchange. So we can get rid of this. And then I can get rid of the one down here, too, because the consumption expenditures will be identically equal to the value of the output that those consumption expenditures purchase. Now we can think of the system as a nice closed circular flow system in which businesses pay income to households. Households in turn purchase goods from the business firms, and in response to that, the business firms produce some more goods, which the household, you know, just goes around it. However, there's obviously something left out. What happens if the households choose not to spend all of the income they get, but instead to put some into saving? Now, households do save. Huh? What happens then? We've got a leak down here called saving. Well, the answer is that consumption expenditures are not the total of expenditures for business output. There's another important component of private expenditure, and that's called investment expenditure. Now, very quickly, investment expenditure means the purchase of capital. Capital means goods that are used to produce future goods. Obvious examples of capital are factories, machinery. What about an automobile? Is an automobile capital? Well, you know, I said capital is goods used to produce future goods. When you purchase an automobile, what are you purchasing it for? You're purchasing it because you want to get a future service out of that, right? You want to be able to drive around. You want future transportation. So an automobile really is capital. In fact, when you think about it, even strawberries are capital because you purchase a quart of strawberries intending to get future nourishment and pleasure from them. In a way, everything turns out to be capital, and that gets muddy. So what happens is the accountants and statisticians who keep track of these things make an arbitrary division. They say anything that's purchased by a business firm is capital. Everything purchased by households is consumption, with one exception. Purchases of new homes are counted as investment rather than consumption. Now, this is a distinction that needn't bother you. It's something for the accountants and statisticians to worry about. But there, it is important that you keep in mind that there is, even though it's a continuum, you can't precisely distinguish consumption expenditures from investment expenditures. There are some expenditures that people undertake regularly, almost as a matter of necessity, which will be fairly stable. Like, you know, your expenditures on food and clothing tend to be pretty stable from month to month, from year to year. But expenditures on some other kinds of goods, you know, big ticket items, and of course, business expenditures on factories and new machinery, these are expenditures that can be postponed for a long time. These are expenditures undertaken with an eye to the distant future. So they are much less stable. They tend to fluctuate greatly from year to year. Right, now, coming back to the question, what happens if the households do some saving? The classical, traditional answer prior to Keynes was, well, that saving will be borrowed by investors. And do remember this, that investment in economics is an expenditure. Now, you may, if you don't spend $50 a month out of your income and put it in the bank, you think of yourself maybe as investing. And in a sense, you are. But basically, what you're doing is saving. Saving is not spending income. Investment is spending. That's the distinction. Investment is a spending act, and saving is a non-spending act. Okay? So the traditional answer was that if households do some saving, business firms and investors generally will borrow those savings, or maybe the savers will directly invest, but in any event, investment will balance saving. And you say, well, gee whiz, what if it doesn't? And the answer was, well, there are mechanisms at work to make sure that it does. Suppose, for example, that savers are trying to save lots more than investors want to invest. Well, that's going to mean that there's lots of money floating around, right? You can borrow easily. Savers are out on the street saying, please take some. And what will happen? Interest rates will go down. Prices of capital goods will fall. Oh, I don't want to get into the technical, but all sorts of things will happen. Prices, relative prices will adjust until finally the quantity demanded will be equal to the quantity supplied of loanable funds. Saving and investment will be equal, and the circular flow will be complete. So the idea was that there's a mechanism which guarantees that whatever that comes through here doesn't go through here will come through here. And in that way, we never get recessions. Now, I think you can see what's wrong with that. The basic thing wrong with it is that we do get recessions. And any theory which explains why we cannot have recessions must have a fatal flaw. John Maynard Keynes, and I'm now distinguishing between Keynes and his disciples, John Maynard Keynes said that the fatal flaw in this way of reasoning was that it abstracted from uncertainty and groping and mistakes and the fact that we really live our economic life in historical time. Economists, Keynes said, had a nasty habit. I'm not going to erase this beautiful diagram, which I worked on for a long time. Keynes said that economists had the habit of abstracting from time and uncertainty in doing their economic analysis. Now, here's a very traditional piece of economic analysis. Anybody who's taken a college course in economics has seen this done by his professor many times. The professor will say, well, you want to know what will happen if there's a decline in demand for beef and an increase in demand for pork? Put the price of beef on this axis and the quantity of beef demanded on this axis. And let's say here's the supply curve of beef and here's the original demand curve for beef. And if the demand declines like this, this is demand 2, this is demand 1, what will happen is that the price of beef will fall from here to here and the quantity of beef produced and consumed will fall from here to here. End of the story. Now, what does that neglect? That neglects the time that it takes for this to happen. It pretends that beef cattle are created and killed instantaneously, that there's no lag. It pretends that farmers are producing beef in response to known prices. It abstracts from riots and demonstrations. It abstracts from the National Farmers Organization. It abstracts from six suicides on the way from here to here. It abstracts from the fact that, well, let me just make this a little more realistic. And this is still a gross oversimplification, but I think you will agree, when we're talking about agricultural produce, it is more realistic. Suppose now that this is the supply curve for beef cattle. What it means is that if the price of beef is up here, farmers will want to supply this quantity of beef. If the price of beef falls down here, they'll only want to supply this quantity. But you know what happens is that farmers never know what the price is going to be when they make their decisions. You know, when they go out there and breed those heifers or whatever they do, my knowledge of these things is strictly derived from second-grade birds and bees lecture. But I know there's something that cattle have to do a long time before you get T-bone steaks. And what happens is farmers make these decisions well in advance. And, of course, other farmers are making decisions about the amount of grain to plant, feed grains. And suppose now that the farmers think the price is going to be up here. So they decide to produce this quantity of cattle or beef. But in fact, the demand curve, they didn't know this. No farmer knows what the demand curve is going to be. But the demand happens to be way down here. This is the actual demand. Well, what's going to happen? When they throw this quantity of beef on the market, the price is going to fall down here. And farmers will be furious. But what they will do is they'll get rid of all those cattle. And by the time they adjust, the quantity of beef will fall way down to here. And so, lo and behold, the price will be up here. And they'll always be wrong. And we've seen it. You know. And you can, by drawing the demand curve a little more steeply than the supply curve, we can have the price going like this. But clearly, this is the kind of world in which production decisions take place. When the federal government, when the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries gets together and jacks up the price of petroleum, so that all of a sudden Americans start paying more for gasoline and become fuel conscious and shift over to small cars and they like European cars better than American cars, the price of American automobiles does not fall neatly down the supply curve, and workers don't shift neatly from automobile production into the production of other things. Workers don't migrate from areas from Detroit to Atlanta. There are maladjustments. It takes time. This, Keynes said, is the essence of the unemployment and recession problem. Now, he went on, and here was his key contribution. After insisting that mistakes get made and that economists are making a serious mistake in supposing that adjustments occur instantaneously, timelessly, on the basis of perfect information, everybody sees the supply curve, sees the demand curve, and you know, you move from one equilibrium to the next equilibrium, that's obviously nonsense. Keynes said, now when you apply this to that whole circular flow model, take a look at what happens. I think figure this out for yourself. Suppose that all of a sudden, suppose we are in equilibrium, meaning everything's flowing smoothly, we have full employment, whatever that means, no inflation. Now all of a sudden, for some reason, savers decide they want to save more. Maybe it's because they're getting richer and they want to retire early. Or maybe it's because the rumor spreads that good times like this can't last forever and people start laying aside for a rainy day. Now what will actually happen? Well, what happens when consumers unexpectedly reduce their spending is that business firms find sales declining. They find that they're disappointed. They produced goods, and the goods aren't moving. What do business firms do? They do not immediately lower their prices. They wait. They hope. They pray. They spend a little more on advertising. They call a sales force together and nag. But what continues to happen is that they don't sell, the goods don't sell, and inventories begin to pile up. Now, what does a business executive do when he finds his inventories piling up? He cuts back on production. Huh? He says, gee, we can't maintain this level of production. But when business firms cut back on production, what happens to people's incomes? Incomes go down. And what effect will that have on people's consumption expenditures? they'll go down again. The idea of Keynes, a very simple one, is that when spending doesn't live up to business expectations, that sets off a series of adjustments that leads to a decline in income, which causes spending to fall further, which of course leads business firms to be disappointed once again in their sales. And so they cut back their output once more, and so incomes fall again. And this continues until finally incomes have fallen so far that people can't save as much as they want to save. In other words, to put it briefly, the old classical mechanism said that if savers, for some weird reason, want to save more than investors want to spend, prices will adjust and bring those intentions into equality and we won't have a recession. Keynes said, not at all. If savers want to save more than investors want to spend, that will cause a recession, which will make people so poor that they won't be able to save more than investors want to spend. And saving and investment will be equal indeed, but at very low levels, and we'll be in a recession with high unemployment. Now, that notion, I think, was Keynes' great contribution to modern economics. I think it is valid. I think his emphasis on the importance of uncertainty is very, very important, because economists have tended and still tend to abstract from uncertainty. The assumption that everybody has perfect knowledge is deeply rooted in economic theory. Economic theory is a highly logical structure of rational action. And I won't pick on economic theory any further. I just do want to say, before passing on, that I think this contribution of Keynes is extremely important. It has not been refuted or rejected, and I think it's going to live. But, as so often happens, the disciples carried on after the master passed from the scene. And what the disciples did with this has, I think, been disastrous. Whereas Keynes was saying this kind of timeless equilibrium analysis, this notion that you know exactly where everything is and you can make smooth, quick adjustments, whereas Keynes was saying that's a disastrous notion, his disciples said that his disciples restored that notion. Only they took omniscience, all-knowingness, away from consumers and investors and gave it unto the Council of Economic Advisers. It's a very interesting thing, I think, that the people who were responsible for teaching the economics profession that consumers and investors cannot predict the future perfectly made the assumption of assuming that they themselves could predict the future perfectly. Or as one of Keynes' radical disciples, Joan Robinson, has put it, the trouble with Keynes' followers is that they wrapped the whole thing up in the cocoon of equilibrium once again. But what they did was assume that, and this is what passed into the textbooks, what they did was assume that there is some level of consumption plus investment spending that will yield an output which is consistent with full employment. Let me call that, full employment level of output. Or for short, we'll call it FALU. Huh? I like that term, FALU. It carries... if you've read Kurt Vonnegut, concept of a grand balloon, it's...
If you would see a grand balloon, just remove the skin of a toy balloon.
Yeah, that's the, a grand balloon in Kurt Vonnegut is a group of people who have no common purpose, nothing really holding them together, who imagine that they are a unity. His example is Hoosiers. Or
D.A.R.
The D.A.R., yeah, they're all kinds of things. American Legionnaires. Anyway, let's call the full employment level of output the FALU. The idea was developed and taught in the textbooks that there is some level of total spending that will lead to FALU. And if private decisions don't yield that, because investors don't want to spend enough, the government will just step in and make up the difference. So we introduced another little variable in here. C plus I won't lead to FLU, but C plus I plus G can lead to FLU, where G stands for government expenditures. Now, you can complicate this enormously, and it has been complicated enormously. The government not only has the power to increase or decrease its expenditures, it also has the power to change taxes, and that will act upon consumption or investment. So if you don't like increasing government expenditures, you can always argue, well, let the government hold its expenditures down, but cut taxes, and cut taxes by just enough to cause consumption and investment to rise by just enough to lead to FLU. Now, if you think about it, who knows how much consumption spending is going to increase as a result of the March 1975 tax cut? Nobody. And who knows when it is going to increase? Nobody. And who knows where it is going to increase? You know, that happens to be a very important question. To say that consumption expenditures will increase by the full amount of the tax rebate isn't very helpful to business firms that are trying to plan production decisions. Because Detroit is hoping that consumption expenditures on automobiles will increase by the full amount of the tax rebate. I'm sure it won't. But by how much of that is going to go into automobiles? How much of that is going to go into American-produced automobiles? If business firms incorrectly anticipate those outcomes, they're going to make mistakes, which will lead to subsequent necessities for adjustment, which will lead to unemployment again. Because unemployment basically occurs when people make mistakes. If you think about it, if we all knew the future perfectly, there'd never be any unemployment. I mean, people wouldn't work sometimes, but that would be because they didn't want to work at that time. See, when you get laid off against your will, it's because you didn't correctly anticipate the future. And when an employer takes on a lot of people and hires a lot of capital equipment and subsequently has to let some of those people go at cost, because it costs employers to hire people and train them and then let them go and take them back on again, there's a cost to labor turnover. Obviously, the employer didn't anticipate the future correctly. If we all anticipated the future correctly, we wouldn't have an unemployment problem. We wouldn't have recessions. Recessions basically are caused by uncertainty. And the government doesn't know the future. We have certainly learned this in the last few years any better than private consumers and investors know the future. In fact, sometimes the private citizens know the future better because they're concerned with a much smaller part of the future, a part of the future into which they've done some research, often under the impetus of the knowledge that they'll lose their shirts if they don't do adequate research. When a government forecaster makes a mistake, he writes it off to experience. When a private forecaster makes a mistake, he goes bankrupt. So private forecasting is often considerably better than government forecasting. Now, what they did with this, and we're getting now to the notion that recessions and inflations can't exist together. What the disciples of Keynes did was something like this. They said, well, let's put the price level on this axis. That's the average price. Oh, think of it as the consumer price index, if you want to. Everybody's familiar with that. And we'll put the level of output on this axis. Let's call that gross national product at, you know, constant prices. Now, suppose that demand, aggregate demand, looks like this. And let's suppose that that stands for the total of consumption, investment, and government expenditures. That's the little big Greek sigma that means the sum of. Right? Call it aggregate demand, total demand. Suppose that total demand looks like that. And let's suppose that that is the level of total demand that happens to yield FLU. All right? Let's say FLU is right here. All right? That means that we'll get this price level and this level of output, which by definition is the level consistent with full employment. Now, if aggregate demand were less than that, say back here, if this were aggregate demand, what would happen? We would get, they said, this level of output, only this much, and we'd have a big recession and lots of unemployment. And if aggregate demand were like this, we would get this level of prices. Now, notice something here. The assumption is that if aggregate demand is inadequate, let me call this inadequate aggregate demand, inadequate aggregate demand. If aggregate demand is inadequate, see, there's, well, I'm sure losing that talk then. It's very hard to find. If it falls short by this amount of what we need for flu, we'll get recession. If it exceeds by this amount what we need for flu, we won't get more. Oh, goody, young rats. We're running into inadequate chalk. Now we have excessive chalk. If we get excessive aggregate demand, we're going to get a rise in the price level or inflation. So now if I take everything unnecessary off of here, I'll leave it up and show you. What we've got is the notion that there's a kind of a kink in the production price curve, like this. If aggregate demand happens to pass right through here, we sing Te Deum. If aggregate demand is excessive, we get inflation. Because, you know, you can't produce any more than the full employment level of output. And when you're at full employment, you're at full employment. You can't go beyond that. That's all you can do. If aggregate demand falls short of that, we won't get declining prices because prices are rigid in the downward direction. Prices just don't go downward for all kinds of institutional reasons. So you get recession and unemployment when demand is inadequate, and you get inflation when demand is excessive. Mm. Now, there's the conclusion. That when that was taught in the principles books, people came to believe that you can't have inflation and recession at the same time, because inflation is the consequence of excessive aggregate demand, recession is the consequence of inadequate aggregate demand. Inflation plus recession must be a call for a new way of looking at the problem. Actually, the disciples of Keynes began already in the 50s, suggesting that there were some problems with this. They noticed, for example, that already in the early late 40s, early 50s, we were experiencing a little unemployment with a little inflation. And so they changed this thing. They made it go like this. They argued, I'll put it in up here. They argued that as the economy approaches flu, prices start to rise. So if you want to get full employment, so if you want to get out to here, you're going to have to accept some inflation. How much? Well, they quarreled about that. Estimates range between 4% was probably the top, down to 0.5%, something like that. But nobody figured we could get anything like 12% inflation per year coupled with 8% unemployment. Then there was a very important study made by an English economist. His name was Almerin Phillips. And you may have run across the phrase the Phillips curve. Phillips published a study in 1958. It was an empirical study on the behavior of wage rates and unemployment in Great Britain over many, many years, running back into the 19th century. And Phillips demonstrated that there was a correlation, very strong correlation, between changes in wage rates and changes in unemployment. That wage rates tended to advance when unemployment was low and tended to fall when unemployment was high. Well, now, I don't think that surprises anybody. In periods of high demand for labor, wage rates are going to be bid up. In periods of low demand for labor, wage rates aren't going to rise. They may even tend to fall. Nobody was surprised by that. But then a group of American economists and some British economists extended it. And instead of talking about wage rates, they started talking about prices. And they enunciated the rule that there is a trade-off between employment and inflation. That if you want to get low unemployment, you must accept some inflation. And if you want to eliminate inflation, you know, get the rate of change in the price level down to zero, you have no choice but to accept the high level of unemployment. That is the so-called Phillips curve argument.
If you, I think having been introduced to it, maybe some of you have run across it already and you're familiar with it, but I think once you've heard the term, you will encounter it. If you read Time, Business Week, the Wall Street Journal, any of the business publications, there's a great deal of discussion about the Phillips curve. Nowadays, usually called the repudiated Phillips curve or the ill-famed Phillips curve. It is ill-famed, of course, because events have demolished it. Again, Paul Samuelson was one of the leaders. He was one of the guys who tried to develop an American version of the Phillips curve. Samuelson was trying to suggest is that if you put 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, let's say this is the annual change in the price level, or annual percentage change in prices on this axis, and you put percentage of the civilian labor force that's unemployed down on this axis, you call that unemployment, and we have 2, 4, 6, 8%. By the way, this can go negative. I don't know any way to get the unemployment rate negative, but you can't get the price level negative. You can have prices going down. We haven't seen it in our lifetimes, but it can't happen. 2, 4, 6. All right. Now, Samuelson and a friend of his tried to construct an American Phillips curve based on our experience, and they came up with something that I'm going to draw it very roughly. It went like that. And I drew that kind of blindly, but let's see what it says. That Phillips curve, that's the American Phillips curve. It says, if you want to get zero inflation, you must accept 8.5% unemployment. If you want to get unemployment down to 3%, you must accept 4.5% annual increase in the price level. So there's a trade-off. You got to choose. Now, the nice thing would be to get inside here. See, here's where we'd like to be. Or since most people agree that you can't get unemployment down to zero, even in 1944, unemployment was 1.2% of the labor force. There's always some shifting around. So let's take, it's interesting that this target has gone up. But let's just take 3% as a target. What we would like to get maybe is right here. We'd like to get 3% unemployment, which is roughly consistent with full employment, and no price inflation. But the argument was, we can't have that. Why does the Phillips curve lie out here? Well, labor unions and corporate monopolies and government policies and who knows what all. But this offers the best menu of choices. What you'd like is lobster and steak, but you can't have it because lobster and steak lies back here somewhere. You're going to have to take hamburger and beans. Or you can have hot dogs and coleslaw. Can't get back in here. Now, that is a very dangerous notion. I hate to draw it. I've drawn this for students and had them bring it back to me on the exam as the Phillips Law. It's always dangerous to present an erroneous idea too clearly or present anything to students too clearly. Remember only what is clear. To argue from the historical association between inflation, let me stress it. There is historically an association between the price level and the unemployment level, and for obvious reasons, that prices tend to rise in boom periods, bid up by rising demand, running against supply constraints. And that's going to be a period when the job market is strong. People can find jobs. So you do find historically that there's a correlation between low unemployment and inflation. But to argue that you can now manipulate this, that you can achieve lower unemployment by getting more inflation, is to commit a very serious fallacy. Let me give you an example. A colleague of mine suggested this. I think it's a brilliant example. The athletic director at the university notices that there is a correlation between the size of the crowds at the basketball game and the number of people in attendance. So they have a poor basketball team, losing season, poor crowds, they're losing money, and so he heats up the gymnasium. That's the fallacy. The mere fact that you get a lot of heat in the gymnasium when a lot of bodies are there doesn't mean that you're going to get a lot of bodies there just because the gymnasium is hot. The causal relationship runs from
See, the rising demand, now going back to economics, the rising demand leads both to rising prices and falling unemployment. And the falling demand leads to falling prices or a slowdown in the rate of inflation and rising unemployment. But to get in there and jiggle the inflation level in the hope that you're going to change the unemployment level does not work. And there is no logical reason to think it will work. And it, the notion that it will work, I got pretty thoroughly exploded in 1971 and then for sure in 1974 and 1975. I say pretty thoroughly exploded, but in fact there are some people who hang on to it. George Meany hangs on to it. Hubert Humphrey hangs on to it. I'm afraid Gerald Ford has been converted unto it. It's a very easy doctrine for politicians to buy because when unemployment is high, what kinds of demands are placed on government? You know, demands to spend more, cut taxes. The Federal Reserve is told to lower interest rates, stop tightening up on the money supply. So there's real pressure on government in periods of high unemployment to do things to increase aggregate demand. And of course, the answer comes back from those who don't want inflation, but that will cause inflation. Usually comes back from the business community, which is correct, that will cause inflation. But then it looks like a struggle between George Meany, who's defending high employment and thinks inflation isn't much of a problem, and the business community, which of course is only interested in preventing inflation and really doesn't care how high the rate of unemployment is. At least that's the way the argument emerges. And that the fact that you have people on one side screaming, watch out for inflation, like right now. There are people who are warning against the March 1975 tax cut on the grounds it would cause inflation. And there are other people who are saying it wasn't great enough to restore full employment. They're really talking past each other, but it seems as if they're talking to one another, and it encourages the idea that inflation and unemployment are really alternatives between which we can choose. All righty, I'm just about through. All right, now, why then have we had, since 1968, but particularly in 1971 and with a vengeance in 1974, very rapid rates of inflation coupled with high unemployment? The answer is, in the first place, the very high level of government spending beyond the rate of taxes. That's the basic explanation. Since 1966, actually, but there's a lag effect here, the federal government has consistently been spending far more than it's been collecting in taxes. And it has been financing this through borrowing from the Federal Reserve System, which leads to an increase in the money supply. So what we've got is the federal government is running big deficits. The Vietnam War was a large part of the cause, but that wasn't the only cause. The federal government was also committed to enormous expenditure programs, subsidies to education, subsidies all over the place. Federal government, the federal budget grows almost automatically, and it's been getting huge. It's been increasing faster than the willingness of Congress and the President to levy taxes. And so what happens is the banking system is asked to supply the funds, and it does, and the level of monetary demand goes up. Monetary demand has been increasing faster than the ability of the economy to supply goods, and that always leads to inflation. Then why have we had recession? We've had recession in part because we don't know how to eliminate recessions. Recessions are the product of uncertainty. We can moderate them, but the policies of the federal government since 1968 have probably aggravated rather than moderated recessions, because the federal government has been pursuing policies almost guaranteed to increase uncertainty. The reason that I would say that the reason we had a major recession in 74-75, when we were, and I'm abstracting from the inflation, because we've all seen that we can have lots of inflation and still have lots of recession and unemployment. I think the major reason we had a deep recession in 74-75 was the uncertainty caused by the policies of the federal government. Now, some of these uncertainties maybe you support. I, for one, support reductions in military expenditures, but they tend to cause recessions. They tend to cause a reallocation of resources. You know, when you transfer resources from gun production to butter production, people don't automatically leap from the airplane factories into the farms. It's hard to convert a munitions maker into a milk-yielding cow. But the federal government has done all sorts of other things. In the field of education, for example, the federal government cranked up enormous programs to turn out PhDs all over the place. And all of a sudden it said, hey, we got too many PhDs. It turned off the pump. And what happens? You get enormous unemployment among PhDs. I've got a recipe. In fact, I wrote this out once, trying to persuade some people that there was no logical incompatibility between rapid inflation and high unemployment. I wrote out a recipe for rapid inflation coupled with high unemployment. And if this sounds like a description of government policies in recent years, that's the way it was constructed. But I think this would be the ideal way. If you were in charge and you wanted to see how much unemployment you could cause at the same time that you were causing a lot of inflation, here's what you might do. Run huge budget deficits. But don't raise taxes. Finance them through the creation of new money by Federal Reserve purchasing of government bonds. Then, those expenditure programs should change often and unpredictably. Do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. And wars are particularly effective in this context. Your tax policy should change very often and unpredictably. In other words, for a while, what you want to do is encourage businessmen to make a lot of investment expenditures by granting rapid tax write-offs, investment tax credits, and so on, and get all the businessmen, business firms investing. And when they're all cranked up and they've got a lot of capacity, start penalizing them for that. Levy an excess profits tax and slap controls on investment. And then, before business firms have an opportunity to adjust to that, come right back in with new investment tax credit. In other words, the idea is make the ball game uncertain, because uncertainty leads to more unemployment. Also, it helps a lot if you periodically... that fire's going to smoke if you don't close that door. It will smoke anyway, but it will smoke outward. Then the other thing you want to do is you periodically threaten to raise corporate income taxes, because that makes business firms highly uncertain in what to do. And to make those threats credible, of course. And then a great thing to do is impose price controls. That really helps. Price controls do not stop inflation, but they sure do cause unemployment. Because when you impose price controls, what's going to happen is that some people are going to get the stuff and some aren't, and it's going to be very unpredictable, and some firms will have to shut down. We saw a lot of that after 71. Firms closing down because they couldn't get the essential materials. Or just idiotic changes in costs. Example was a steel firm that had to use high-quality lumber to make pallets because it couldn't obtain cheap grades of lumber. And the reason it couldn't obtain cheap grades of lumber because there were price controls on lumber, which was causing all the lumber firms to produce only the high-quality lumber, on which the controls were less effective. They're just all kinds of examples. Anybody, any businessman, I think, who was engaged in 72, 73 in large-scale purchases can tell you horror stories about supplies drying up, necessitating production cutbacks. Well, that's a great way to cause unemployment. Of course, it would help, too, if you can have the State Department encourage the American international oil companies to cooperate with the Arabs in jacking up the price of oil. Now, I think that today the OPEC countries could do it on their own, but I don't think they could have a couple of years ago. It's well worth remembering that the large American international oil companies were aided by our State Department in the process of aiding the Arab countries to control prices and production levels of oil. Why did our State Department do that? I don't know. Perhaps they were trying to see how much inflation coupled with unemployment they could create. Another good thing to do is impose detailed but unenforceable controls on job safety procedures and emission of pollutants. And then, after everybody sees that the legislation is unworkable, after though they've begun to adjust to it, rescind it. That helps a lot. Creates a lot of waste, mistakes. Impose and remove, in as unpredictable a way as possible, import quotas and tariffs
taxes and other controls on foreign investment and export subsidies. Well, I won't go on. You can add your own ingredients as soon as you understand the formula. The way to create maximum unemployment coupled with maximum inflation is to, for the federal government to spend a lot of money, which it borrows from the Federal Reserve, so the Federal Reserve is increasing the money supply, and meanwhile have the federal government creating just as much uncertainty as it possibly can for private decision makers. And you will get something like we had in 74-75. A final ironic note. While the federal government has been doing all of these things, a lot of people have believed that the federal government should and could prevent inflation and unemployment. As a result of some very subtle propaganda by a colleague, many of you are a compatriot of all of you from Minnesota, Walter Heller, largely through the oratorical talents of Walter Heller, but he was aided and abetted by a lot of other people, the notion gained currency in the 60s that government officials, preferably Democrats, advised by shrewd economists like Walter Heller, would be able to control the economy, control aggregate demand so neatly that we could eliminate inflation and eliminate unemployment. Now, you know, there was always that Phillips curve constraint. Maybe we couldn't get rid of it all, but we could really get her down. That was called fine-tuning. I believe Heller coined the phrase fine-tuning. He's a master phrase coiner. The Republicans did not agree, and a lot of Democrats didn't either. The reason that Heller got through his tax cut of 1964 was not because Congress and the public believed that Heller knew how to fine-tune the economy. Heller at the time was chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors. The reason that tax cut went through was because most Americans thought taxes were too high. They weren't accepting any sophisticated arguments about fine-tuning. They just wanted their taxes reduced. But then Heller said, see, all this marvelous prosperity that has opened up before us was due to our skill in fine-tuning. He never points out that they tried fine-tuning the other direction in 68 and it bombed. In fact, there is no evidence that fine-tuning worked, but there's a lot of evidence that fine-tuning doesn't. The analogy that I prefer to the notions of the federal government changing taxes and changing monetary policy and changing expenditures in order to compensate for private fluctuations is the analogy of an elephant in a rowboat. You know, if there's a rowboat on a choppy sea and an elephant in it, the elephant could, by adjusting his weight with precision and grace, compensate for fluctuations in the rowboat and keep everything on an even keel. But if you were in the rowboat with the elephant, would you rather that the elephant tried to balance the boat or sat still? It is conceptually possible for the federal government to fine-tune the economy, but in practice, I don't think it is possible at all. And there's a great deal of evidence that the efforts of the federal government to fine-tune have been responsible for a good deal of the increase in instability. At least we have this fact, that not until 1971 did both political parties commit themselves to the fine-tuning position. And the worst inflation plus unemployment that we ever saw took place after both political parties committed themselves to the view that they could and would prevent inflation and unemployment. That's interesting. All right. I'm through with my speech. No, don't. All right, you now start firing objections.
I'd like to do just a tiny bit of name dropping. Friends of mine over the years around Minnesota have said, in the Western world, the real debate is between Marx and Keynes. And I have had a playful response. I said, not really. The real debate in the future will be between the Austrian economists represented by Hayek and Hallmor Schacht. And Hallmor Schacht is an amazingly attractive figure. It just happens to be he was with the Nazi regime.
I hate to hear you bracket Hayek and Schacht. Because Hayek is so anti fascist man from nothing.
I said they're opposite poles. I said the debate is between Hayek and Schock. Friends of mine said the debate in the Western world is between Marx and Keynes. I said somewhat playfully, being demagogic, that the debate in the future will be between the Austrian economists, represented by Hayek, and Hallmar Schock.
Okay, all right. I thought you were pushing something. Yeah. Well, I think that's more insightful and playful. But Hayek represents a view that while the free market isn't perfect, it's the best we got, and intervention is almost certain to do more harm than good in an economic sense, and Hayek argues that it is even more certain to do more damage to personal liberty. Whereas the dominant view in the world today, I don't agree with you, it's not a Marxist view, it's not really a Keynesian view, it's kind of the view that the government can do anything. And the trick is simply to get good men in government.
Incidentally, Hayek did not go to prison, although he escaped by this much. And as a form of repentance, he dedicated his services to the state of Israel. I don't know whether they accepted them or not. When the Nuremberg trials had ended, and he escaped jail. He should not have been in jail.
Been jailed by whom? Hitler, you mean?
Well, I'm speaking too fast. He was brought up before the Nuremberg because he aided Hitler so much.
Hayek?
Schock.
I'm getting Hayek and Schock. All right, okay.
Schock was brought up before the Nuremberg trial, but he was not jailed. He then, as a form of repentance for being with the Nazis, dedicated his services to the State of Israel as an economic expert.
Okay. I'm not here.
Yes, sir. One question that I didn't hear mentioned, perhaps I missed it, but one point was that the cause of inflation was nailed to other things than the lack of productivity by the individuals that are now producing in the plants and industrial world. Now, I didn't hear anything of that sort, but yet there is actual figures that show that the man-hour productivity of men working has sufficiently dropped almost 20% in the last few years. Now, doesn't that have a bearing on the inflation?
Yeah, it does. You see, it depends upon what you want to take as given and what you want to take as controllable. I tend to regard increases in productivity as a kind of given. But in any event, we would agree that inflation occurs when the money supply, or the rate of monetary demand, increases faster than the rate of productivity. Now, you know, if the rate of monetary demand is increasing at 8% and productivity is increasing at 4%, you can get 4% inflation. If productivity falls to 3%, you'll get 5% inflation. So you can, if you wish, assign the inflation to a decline in productivity. I don't think that's terribly useful, because no one knows very much about how to increase productivity, you know, other than NAG. We know a great deal about how to control the level of monetary demand. So I would argue that if increases in productivity are occurring at a 0% rate, The thing to do is not to nag or try to, well, it gets into the whole question of zero economic growth and how fast a rate of increase in productivity we want. But it seems to me that there's one variable that governments do control, that is the level of monetary demand. They don't control it with precision, but they control it in the aggregate and with long time lags. And the thing to do is to adjust the supply of money to the supply of real goods. And what you're saying, if I hear you correctly, is you can also, to some extent, adjust the supply of goods to the supply of money. And that's true, but I don't think it's a very useful approach. Of course, it's an approach that a lot of government officials prefer, because, you know, well, they don't like to be told that it is their policies which are responsible for the inflation, so they go out and read lectures to labor unions and to businessmen and to everyone else about their irresponsibility in not increasing the rate of productivity. That's been a very popular pastime for American presidents in recent years. And whatever the truth in it, I think it's a council of despair. I've never heard of a labor union that abandoned a feather bedding policy because the president asked them to. And you know, if nagging could increase productivity, Great Britain would today be the wonder of the world.
be the Japan of Europe. But I think Great Britain is a good demonstration that nagging does not increase productivity. So are we? I don't think we're in disagreement.
I think the best way to anticipate the end of a recession is to figure that if it's gone on for about a year, it'll probably end soon. Maybe not. No, it's a fact that forecasting of this sort has been abominable. The best forecasts have come from economists employed by business firms. That's consistently, it helps to know a lot, but it also helps to be in a business firm where your mistaken forecasts will...
For better or worse, Heller is certainly a consultant for lots of Minnesota business firms.
Is he?
Well, one reason he left Washington is that his salary there was too small. University, he's a Regents professor at $60,000. He makes another $80,000 a year as a consultant for Minneapolis business firms. First National Bank and several others.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I don't know how valuable the kind is. I know a lot of business firms, large business firms, hire economists, especially prominent economists, as window dressing.